Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. We get together on the internet to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. Hey, good morning. Welcome to Solder Smoke 56. It's Sunday, the 29th of April. The time, 06:18 Greenwich Mean Time, here in London. Well, and all over the world, of course. We're continuing on our outer space theme a little bit this morning. For those of you who are a little bit more down to earth, just bear with us. We'll just have a couple of things to mention here in the outer space area at the beginning of the show, and then we'll get back to more down-to-earth solder smoking. I was struck this week by the, I thought, inspirational photograph of Dr. Stephen Hawking floating in zero-G, or simulated zero-G, on the parabolic flight on the aircraft that is somewhat, I guess, affectionately referred to as the Vomit Comet. It just was a great picture, and he looked up to be having a really great time. I had the privilege of meeting Dr. Hawking here in London a few months ago, and it was at an event in which some American astronauts were making presentations about their shuttle mission. And I heard off in the corner during the presentation the computer-generated voice that that Stephen Hawking uses because of his physical limitations, and it came out as what I thought was a joke. He said, "I want to follow you in space. I want to follow you in space," or something like that. I thought he was joking, but apparently not. And I think I read that he's also making preparations to follow up and be one of the early participants in the commercial space flights that are being launched by various companies. So, well, good for you, Stephen Hawking, and glad you enjoyed the zero-G adventure. Another space related event came to my attention via, I think it came to me via Makezine or some other internet source. And it has to do with a dish antenna. We've made frequent mention on the show here of our fondness for the movie, the great Australian technical movie called The Dish, about the Parkes radio telescope in Australia that was used to get to receive the first images, the images of man's first steps on the moon during the Apollo 11 mission. Well, of course, there were other similar dishes around the world used during the Apollo project, and one of them is known as the James Berg Earth Station in, I guess it's Cachagua Valley in California, about 20 miles southeast of Monterey. And this is a magnificent looking antenna. I mean, I'm looking at it right now, a picture of it, and it's just amazing. It's huge. And for those of, well, I guess all of us are fond of antennas, and if you're fond of astronomy too, in addition to your interest in ham radio, this kind of antenna is just almost too good to be true. Well, it I'll read you a little description of it from the James Berg Station webpage. It says here, this facility went into service in 1969, just in time to carry the moon landing live to the world. COMSAT owned and operated this high-capacity Earth station, and provided all forms of overseas communications via satellite between the U.S. and points all around the Pacific Rim. The antenna, taller than a 10-story building, is located in the Upper Carmel Valley. The facility was closed in 2002 and sold to a private investor. The new owner is cooperating with a group of ham radio operators to find a new use for the antenna, which may include radio astronomy, educational, or deep space applications. There's a project, guys, that is extremely interesting. And, you know, we're going to have kind of an unusual band sweep segment this week. It's going to be short, but unusual. The hams who are working on James Berg Station, being true radio amateurs, immediately decided to get on the air with this thing, and they didn't try to load it up on 80 meters. they put it to use on the frequencies closer to those that it was intended for, and they used it for moon bounce. Now, moon bounce is really, I guess, at the opposite end of the technological spectrum from the QRP rigs that most of us spend most of our time with. But there's, some common ground between the moon bouncers and the QRPers, and that is that it's technical. It's electronics. It's a technical challenge. And I've heard many times people say that moon bounce represents the greatest technical challenge for the radio amateur. And I've always kind of seen the logic behind that kind of statement. And they used James Berg Station antenna for moon bounce, for phone moon bounce. And they put up a YouTube video of that particular QSO. It actually wasn't a QSO. It was just them listening to their voices bounce back off the moon. I think it's pretty cool. A lot of us who've played with kind of high-orbit satellites are used to hearing that very slight delay in the signal going up to the high-Earth orbit satellite and then back down. But, of course, the delay to the moon is much more noticeable. So I'm going to play for you now the audio portion of the YouTube video about the James Berg Station moon bounce QSO, and that'll be this week's segment for Band Sweep. And just listen for that delay and think about everything that's involved in it. So here we go. Thanks to the guys from James Berg Station.
Who's driving right now?
Kevin.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 4, 3, 2, 1.
Who's doing the control and voice?
Alpha Delta 6 India Whiskey. Who's calling?
All right. So I thought that was really interesting. You know, as we wrap up this the outer space portion of this week's show, I want to just mention to you guys that there's a, I know we're not really a very contest-oriented group, but I suppose we have our competitive instincts here. There's a trophy out there, guys, that's waiting for one of us to pick it up. It's been out there for a long time. It's remained unclaimed. It's sitting on display at ARRL headquarters. Many of you who visited Newington, Connecticut may have seen it. I refer here, of course, to the Elser Mathis Cup. I'll have to explain this to some of our listeners who might not be familiar with this particular award. It says here, let me see, I'm reading a statement. I guess this is from an ARRL website, and I'll just read to you from this site. It says here, all the news about the Mars probe that has apparently been lost has renewed interest in the Elser Mathis Cup. Visitors to ARRL HQ may recall having seen the unusual trophy on display. It's intended to mark the occasion of the first two-way amateur radio contact between Earth and Mars. The actual bowl of the cup is borne by images of beings that only coincidentally resemble the large-eyed hominids of alien abduction lore. Yeah, right, I suppose they intend us to believe that. Going on, although that was not the intention, really. Let's see. The story of the Elser Mathis Cup appeared in the November 1969 issue of QST. In his article, That Planet Mars QSO Cup, Colonel Fred Johnson Elser, W6FB, excellent call, recalled meeting lead founder Hiram Percy Maxim, W1AW, in the 1920s. He learned that Maxim had an interest in Mars and even owned a globe of the Red Planet. Later, back in the Philippines, which was in 1928 under U.S. jurisdiction, Elser was inspired by a visit with Lieutenant Commander Stanley Mathis, K1CY, to offer, quote, a unique trophy for the first two-way communication with Maxim's pet planet, Mars. The actual trophy selected by Elser and Mathis was selected by Elser Mathis during a trip to Bangu, is an example of Igorot native wood carving. Quote, the base symbolizes Earth, and the seated figures are its inhabitants. The bowl is Mars, and the standing men are the amateurs who bridge the gap of space. The plate is fastened to the cup and includes space for the names, call signs, and dates of those who will fulfill the cup's eventual destiny. So I think it's something to think about, fellas. I don't think it's really going to be done at QRP levels, but I don't know, with an antenna like those guys out in California have, who knows? But maybe at least for the first few QSOs, the use of a linear would be, I think, justified. All right, that brings us to the end of the outer space segment of Solder Smoke 56. I'm sure many of you are breathing a sigh of relief. Going far, much back down, more back down to Earth now. In Solder Smoke 54, I mentioned Frank Jones and the 5-meter Liberation Army. Frank Jones, of course, is a really legendary author and a technical expert, wrote many articles about simple VHF and, well, I guess mostly VHF gear during the 30s and 40s, and really a very inspirational homebrew figure. A lot of his articles are still around. I have a book that's a collection of his articles. He was particularly fond of a band that we lost somewhere along the line, the 5-meter band. And I guess about 8 or 9 years back, a radio amateur, Michael Hopkins, started a series of fictional stories about sort of Frank Jones coming back to life and organizing what became known as the FMLA, the 5-meter Liberation Army. I thought it was pretty good. I think that there was a lot of folks out there who didn't like it, didn't think it fit in with QRPL, but I thought it did. I thought there was room in QRPL and certainly enough room on the internet for this kind of creative writing, and I liked it. I thought it was fun. You don't get too many chances to read fiction about our hobby, and here it was. And Michael put out these articles, I guess, over a period of a couple of years. Now, he's since become a silent key, but for some reason, in the last few weeks, I went back and started trying to dig up from the QRPL archives some of his articles. There's something that happened just in the last couple of weeks that made me think about this even more, and that is the appearance on supermarket shelves here in the United Kingdom of some very, very inexpensive handy talkies for intended, kind of for a family radio service, I guess they'd call it. But they're built for 49 megahertz. 49 megahertz, guys. I mean, they're just begging to be modified for the 6 meter band. Not quite for 5 meters, but I guess if the 5 meter liberation movement ever crosses the Atlantic, and if our British cousins are inspired to join us in this effort to liberate what were formerly radio amateur frequencies, I guess these walkie-talkies could play an important role. Anyway, they're on sale at Tesco. I don't think you guys in the States have Tesco's yet, although I think they're starting to open up in California. But if you're in the UK, you're pretty much always within, oh, I don't know, you know, 10 or 15 yards of a Tesco. I exaggerate, but sometimes it seems that way. But Tesco, which is, of course, a fine institution, and I'm sent off there on shopping missions quite frequently. They're selling these things for £5. These days, guys, that's about $10. And I think in many, many corners of ham shacks in the UK, there are these kind of plastic-wrapped HTs on their way towards modification. So with that in mind, and I think it would be good to read just one paragraph from Michael Hopkins' description of Frank Jones and the 5 meter Liberation Army. Here goes. Frank is all homebrew. His receiver is unshielded outside, but built around a central square of aluminum that houses a velvet veneer dial through the front panel and some tubes I did not recognize jutting horizontally on both sides of the box where coils also plug in. The transmitter is a multi-stage affair on a piece of particle board. The tubes are vertical here, and the bench was littered with round Hammerlin coils labeled 5, 10, 20, and 80. The 40-meter coils were in place, and Frank worked a few stations at dizzying speed with a J-38. He never used the same call twice, and when he offered me a turn, I declined. The only transformer in the place was a small screen modulator attached to a pair of TH-100s labeled PA in the rack below the New as Tomorrow computer. He seemed to be taking all his DC off the three-wire service line that entered through a large piece of plastic DWV pipe and where, in turn, a run of fiber optics snaked out and disappeared along a railroad right-of-way. I eased towards the back of the trailer, but Frank ignored the hint and suggested lunch. Anyway, I think Michael had a good style, and certainly unusual. So let's see if we can dig up the 5 meter Liberation Army articles. I found a few of them on QRPL. I'm sure lots of them are lurking on hard drives out there. And if anybody has any suggestions on how to get the whole set together, let me know. Speaking about my own workbench and homebrew projects, this week I've been trying to sketch out the schematic of this power supply that I picked up at not the last Kempton Park Hamfest, but the one before that. At the last Hamfest, I picked up I met up, as I told you, with Tony Fishpool, and he gave me a copy of his excellent book, Simple Test Equipment for the QRP-er. There's a link to Tony's webpage on the Gadgeteer News page this week, so if you guys are interested in picking this book up, it's just a couple clicks away. Just go to gadgeteer.news and you'll see, the Gadgeteer News portion of my page, which is www.gadgeteer.us, and you'll see Tony's book there. But one of the bits of inspiration that I got from Tony's book was on the need for a current-limited power supply. And I realized I had picked one up at the Hamfest. Excuse me. So this week I've been little by little trying to sketch out the schematic of this thing. It looks to me to be completely homebrew. I don't see any commercial markings on it. So somebody somewhere did a very, very nice job in putting this thing together. The problem is that the current limiting circuitry doesn't seem to be working right. Everything else seems to be okay. The voltages are all right. The voltages on the 0 to 15 supply vary exactly as I move the this little pot on the front panel that you can set it. But what happens is the current limiting circuitry doesn't seem to be working, because if I set the current limit at, say, 500 milliamps and watch the output voltage, when I put a resistor across the terminals that should be drawing, oh, I don't know, just, you know, 15 or 20 milliamps, the current limiting circuitry kicks in and shuts the thing down. It should be shutting down at much higher current levels, but obviously something is wrong in the current limiting circuitry. Alan Yates, our friend down under, wrote in, and he correctly suggested that I should try to sketch out the schematic. That's what I'm doing right now. But he also thought about perhaps modernizing the rig with more modern power supply circuitry and devices. The thing uses AD149 PNP transistors as part of the current limiting circuitry. They're kind of antique at this point. I suspect that they're still okay. I haven't tested them, but I think they're going to be okay. I think there's something else wrong, probably in the current sensing circuitry in there. But I think I'm going to stick with the discrete components. I've dug up the old handbooks and I've been looking at the circuits that are used for current limiting in old discrete component power supplies, and they're kind of interesting. And I'd rather do it with two or three discrete transistors than one kind of black box mystery chip. So thanks for the suggestion, Alan, and thanks for the offer of help. I think I might be able to figure this one out. I'm hoping to make a breakthrough today, but you guys know how it is. One weird thing about this this supply, and I'd appreciate some suggestions on it. Whoever built it in a very nice, solid steel box, but the box, the case, is not grounded at all. All the circuitry in there is floating. There's a ground terminal on the three-way UK plug that comes out, but there's no connection between the ground terminal and the box, which makes me, I don't know, a bit nervous. Let me know if anybody has any thoughts on that. Let's see. Anyway, that's the power supply project, and I have been having some fun with it. Even simple circuitry sometimes can have some very neat and interesting features, and I've had a lot of fun seeing how they use just three transistors and a couple of diodes to come up with a current limiting feature that could save many fingers from being burnt and many transistors from releasing their smoke. Another project in the offing here. Got a very nice package from our friend Thomas up there in Norway, LA3PDA. He sent chips for the W7ZOI power meter that I know that I've been needing for many, many years. So I have the chips in hand now, and this thing is going to be built either here during my last days in London or early in my solder smoke adventures in the new QTH in Rome. So thanks very much for Thomas for sending those along. That's very much in the best old traditions of ham radio, helping out a fellow amateur and getting parts that he needs for a project. Very nice of you to do that. I have a technical design question for the group. I'm hoping this is going to be a bit thought provoking because it's had me scratching my head for a while. Feedback and amplifiers. I've been studying experimental methods and solid state design, and I've had some really great email exchanges with Wes W7ZOI, one of the authors of both of those books, and been using the software and experimental methods and LTSpice and have been really coming to appreciate the benefits of using feedback, both degenerative in the emitter and shunt from the collector back to the base, as a design tool. It allows you to achieve unconditional stability in the amplifiers, and it also allows you to set the gain and the impedances in a way that makes the design process a lot easier. Okay, so great. I understand now, and I can see it. I know why feedback is such a great tool. But here's my question. If it's so great, why don't we use it also in the final amplifier stage? Usually you'll see the design where there's a series of maybe three cascaded feedback amps leading up to the final. And I think that's what happens, for example, in the BitX20. And then, but the final stage usually is sitting there without any feedback. There may be sometimes there may be an unbypassed resistor in the emitter, but usually that final amplifier is without feedback. And I'm wondering why. Wouldn't it, for those of us who find unconditional stability to be a really good thing, wouldn't it make sense to use feedback in the final? I realize you'd be sacrificing a little bit of gain, but that's the name of the game when you use feedback, isn't it? So if anybody out there can tell me why it's so uncommon to see significant feedback circuitry in the final power amplifiers in our designs, I'd be interested in that. Let's see here. Oh, a little bit of web news. Major updates to the Gadgeteer news and video pages. You can get to both of those pages via the www.gadgeteer.us webpage, and I think you'll find them interesting. I've been negligent in not updating these pages, but I've put on there links and articles and things that you might find interesting related to things that we've been discussing on the recent episodes of Solder Smoke. And that, my friends, brings us to a very familiar portion of the show. I gotta take it easy because Billy's still sleeping and he's over in the next room. Welcome to Solder Smoke Mailbag. We got some really good mail this week. I mentioned in the last episode the what I referred to as the Mayfair mystery resistor. This was the 10 ohm resistor that I found while walking down the street in the Mayfair section of London. I think the gong might have woke Billy up. Anyway, I mentioned that I was walking down the street of this very ordinarily electronic-free zone of Mayfair. It's filled with way too expensive restaurants and art galleries and antique furniture places, but usually there's not a resistor or a capacitor anywhere in sight. But there it was, this 10-ohm resistor sitting there on the sidewalk. And it started me thinking about where it came from and what might be going on there. And perhaps my wife joked that maybe I was somehow missing out on a vast culture of electronic homebrewing right there in the heart of central London. Well, that's not really the case. And one of our listeners came back almost immediately from across the pond and solved the mystery. And the guy who provided the solution is Tom, Alpha Alpha 2 Velo, Victor Kilo, AA2VK. And Tom points out, and I'm sure this is the answer, that 10-ohm resistors are very commonly used in alarm systems. Oh, man, one of my the suction cups on the Volkswagen the Volkswagen solar panels just let go. That was the crash you guys might have heard. Wow. They didn't fall far. But I'll have to take care of that. Anyway, back to the resistor. They're used as shunts, very commonly used as shunts in electronic alarm systems. And I'll tell you what, in a neighborhood like Mayfair, I guarantee you there's a lot of electronic alarm systems there protecting all those antiques and all the old furniture and the artwork and everything else. So thanks for Tom. That's surely the result. Some guy probably was out fixing alarm systems and he had a bunch of these stuffed in his pocket. It was actually a good find for me because I don't know about you guys, but when I use up resistors, I guess it's kind of circuitry that we're working on. Usually it's the low value resistors, those 10 ohmers, the 5 ohmers, that you use up a lot. Let me know if you think that's true, because I usually buy these big packs of resistors with a whole range of values. And what I do is I tack them onto a board so that I can just easily pick out the one that I need. And they increase in value along the little paper strip that they're mounted on. And I always seem to run out of the low-value resistors first, because I guess we're using a lot of them is in the emitter circuits of the amplifiers that we're designing. And I always seem to be running out of all the values below about 47 ohms, and whereas I'll have, I'll never sort of run out of the 10 mega ohm resistors. So anyway, thanks to Tom for solving that mystery. And let's see what else on the Solder Smoke mailbag. Let's see what we have here. Got an email from Paolo. Is called as Charlie Tango 1 Echo Fox Lima, and also Golf Zero Mike Uniform Whiskey. We've been getting really a good email from Paolo for a couple of years now, and we always kind of commiserate because we're both operating from urban antenna challenge locations. Paolo comments this time on something I said about the electronic commentary used on some of the Make Zine podcasts. You remember when I said that these the Make Zine folks were prone to saying the soldering was awesome, it was really whacked, kind of things that we just don't kind of terminology we really don't use in ham radio yet anyway, I guess. But he comes back and he says, enjoyed the latest podcast, 5 stars, interviews, book reviews, band sweep, awesome, as the Makes guys would exclaim. It's one of the things I look forward to every week, like receiving a QST in the post. As you know, I'm in a small, antenna-unfriendly studio apartment in Paris. My ham radio operation starts to gain a psychological element, a mind game between the hobby and less-than-ideal operating conditions. Low-power indoor antennas and CW keep me active, and stimuli like your podcast are a very good morale boost. Well, hang in there, Paolo. Fight the anti-radiation elements that you're living with, and we wish you good luck and good DX. Finally, we got a nice email from Scott, KD5NJR, and I guess this brings us back to our astronomical outer space theme here at the end of the show. But Scott points out that there's a book out there that many listeners to the show might find really interesting. It's by the famous science author Tim Ferriss, and it's about people who are involved in homebrew activities that are not in the ham radio area, but are very closely related to things that we're interested in and projects that we do. It's about amateur radio astronomers, and I think it's called Skygazing or Stargazing. I have it on the webpage, so you'll see it on gadgeteer.news. There's a link to it there. And I really liked the book. I read it a few years ago. And Ferriss goes around and meets up with amateur astronomers who are doing really important and interesting technical work from their garages and from their basement workshops. Some of it's electronics, some of it's computers, a lot of it's just telescopes and telescope mirrors. But it's an interesting book about people who have technical addictions very similar to ours, and I think you guys would like it. So check that out. And like I said, a link is on the Gadgeteer news webpage. Well, that brings us to an end for Soda Smoke 56. I hope you guys have liked the show. I hope the weather's starting to turn warm for the majority of us who are here in the northern hemisphere, and I hope the winter is kind to those of you who are down south. That's it for now. Please keep the emails coming. Always like to get them, and let us know if you have any suggestions or anything you'd like us to mention to the whole Solder Smoke universe. 73 is from London.